Former President Harry Truman was speaking of Washington, D.C. politics when he said, "If you want a friend in this city, buy a dog." Our nation's capital is still populated by people jockeying for power. And what is true of D.C. was also true of Israel's ancient royal court. Intrigue and manipulation were common. Understand, King Saul was a weak leader, and the people around him were always on the lookout for openings to be able to grab personal power. Real friendships were difficult to make and maintain, which made the bond between David and Jonathan, Saul's son, so remarkable. Jonathan was the natural heir to Israel's throne, Saul's blood. David, though, was the spiritual heir, God's choice. And yet these two men overcame the potentials for rivalry and jealousy and remained pals for a lifetime. In today's chapters, we see the depth of a brotherly bond between two friends. 1 Samuel 19 begins. "Now Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David." Remember, all David and Jonathan had in common. Both were jealous for God's honor. Both were daring and unafraid to step out and take a venture of faith. Jonathan, remember, attacked a Philistine garrison. David conquered a Philistine giant. Their love for God and their common faith created a bond stronger than blood. And this is why Jonathan refuses now to cooperate with his dad's plan to assassinate David. Jonathan told David, "My father Saul seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning and stay in a secret place and hide. I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. Then what I observe, I will tell you." Jonathan now volunteers to be David's informant. And thus Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his works have been very good towards you." Come on, Dad. David isn't our enemy. He's our ally. And then he recounts David's great victory over Goliath. "For he took his life in his own hands, and he killed that Philistine. And the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel." You saw it, and you rejoiced. "Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause?" And so Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be killed." Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these things. And so he brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past. Jonathan seeks to build a bridge between David and his dad. And I wonder, how willing are we to stand up for our friends, even at the risk of our own well-being? How good of a friend are you? You know, there's a vitamin for friendship. If you want more friends, you can take a vitamin. You know what it is, don't you? B1. How good of a friend are you? Maybe if you don't have friends, it's because you're not a good one yourself. Here, Jonathan is a good friend. He defends his buddy David. Did you hear of the man who left his doctor's office? He said, "Doc, since we're such good friends, I won't insult you with any payment for your services, but I will give you a little something from my last will and testament." Well, the doctor replied, he said, "That's very kind, but can I see that prescription that I gave you? I need to make an adjustment." Neither of these men were very good friends. As the old saying goes, true friends are like diamonds, real and rare. False friends are like leaves scattered everywhere. Hey, if you have a loyal and a committed friend like Jonathan, you're a rich person. Verse 8, "And there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a mighty blow, and they fled from him." And I'm sure the chorus that Saul hated to hear was ringing again in Jerusalem streets. The girls sang it at school. The DJs played it on the radio. Somebody posted it to Spotify. There was even a YouTube video. Saul has slain his thousands, but David, his tens of thousands. David won Saul a great victory, but he enraged Saul's jealousy. And now the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing music with his hand. And we all know from earlier experiences, you don't put a spear within Saul's reach. Oh my. If you do, David duck. Not Donald duck, David duck. Get down, man. For verse 10, then Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away from Saul's presence and he drove the spear into the wall. So David fled and escaped that night. And for the next 20 years, David will be on the run. He'll be a fugitive from Saul. He'll go from place to place with nowhere to call his home. He won't return to the palace until he's been appointed king. Well, Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. Goons were dispatched to set up an ambush outside David's bungalow. And Michal, David's wife, you remember she was also Saul's daughter. Jonathan was Saul's son. Michal was Saul's daughter. Told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed. Michal was in the same situation as her brother Jonathan. Will she side with her husband or with dear old dad? She too does what's right, and she protects an innocent man. You know, God expects his people to obey the king of any form of government unless that government's command is in conflict with God's will, which obviously it was here. You remember what Peter and the apostles said to the Jewish Sanhedrin? It could have been said by Michal to her father Saul. Acts 5, verse 29, we ought to obey God rather than men. And here's what's interesting. While this hit squad stakes out David's house, waiting for the morning light to assassinate him, guess what he's doing? He's inside the house singing praise to God. And how do we know? Psalm 59 is prefaced. When Saul sent men and they watched the house in order to kill him. Psalm 59 are the lyrics that David wrote in his house that very night. And notice how the psalm begins and ends. It starts out, deliver me from your enemies, from my enemies, O my God. Defend me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from the workers of iniquity and save me from bloodthirsty men. At first, David pleads for God's protection. But the song ends in verse 16 of Psalm 59. But I will sing of your power. Yes, I will sing aloud of your mercy in the morning. Remember, Saul's goons were planning to kill David at daybreak. You wonder if he shouted out in his prayer, your mercy in the morning. Loud enough for the assassins to hear. For you have been my defense and refuge in the day of trouble. To you, O my strength, I will sing praises. For God is my defense, my God of mercy. Notice David combats persecution with praise. Praise is a great weapon in our arsenal. Well, back to Psalm 1, 1 Samuel 19, verse 12. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. Ladies, this is the only time letting down your husband is a good thing. She let him down through the window. He escaped in the night. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed, put a cover of goat's hair for its head, and covered it with clothes. So when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, oh, he's sick. And I'm really not sure why a man being sick would stop his assassins from killing him. I mean, if he's going to be dead, what's the problem with him being sick in the first place? I don't understand that really, but perhaps it's in the assassin's code. I'm not sure. Don't kill the sick. But then Saul sent the messengers back to see David, saying, bring him up to me in the bed that I may kill him. Saul says, it doesn't matter to me if he's sick or not. I'll kill him. And note the intensity of the king's hatred for David. I mean, Saul wants to deal the death blow personally. I'll kill him. And when the messengers had come in, there was the image in the bed with a cover of goat's hair for its head, for his head. They discover Michael's ruse. She had put an idol in the bed, made it look like someone was lying there, put goat's hair on its head, made them think it was David. Of course, this is revealing of Michael's spiritual state, that she had an idol nearby to use in the cover-up. What's a devout Jew doing with a graven image? Then Saul said to Michael, why have you deceived me like this and sent my enemy away so that he has escaped? Michael answered Saul. He said to me, let me go. Why should I kill you? And she claims David has threatened her life. Of course, that was a lie. Notice here she falsely accuses her husband to save her own skin. Ladies, that's not a good practice. And so David fled and escaped and went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth. Now the word Naoth means dwellings or huts. Naoth referred to the school of the prophets that Samuel had established in Ramah. And news reaches Saul of David's whereabouts, that he's there with Samuel at this school. Then Samuel sent messengers to David. And when they saw the group of prophets prophesying and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. Saul sends this posse. It arrives inspired by the king's hatred. But notice they are confronted by the Holy Spirit, and they end up inspired by God's love. God turns the tables. Saul's men begin to speak ecstatic and divinely inspired messages. They prophesy before the people. And when Saul was told, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. Each time Saul sends his henchmen, they're overcome by God's Spirit. Then Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they prophesied also. Every time Saul sends someone to Naoth to do his dirty work, they end up getting saved. That's what's happening. You know, we've had folks attend Calvary Chapel, just to go to church, just get mom and dad off my back. They come stubbornly resistant to the message. But when they arrive, they get arrested by God's Spirit and overcome by His love. And they leave touched and aware of God's presence in their life. Well, in verse 22, Saul decides to go himself. So then he also went to Ramah and came to the great well that is at Sikkoh. And so he asked and said, where are Samuel and David? And someone said, indeed, they are at Naoth in the school there in Ramah. And so he went there. And this time God's Spirit powerfully overwhelms and overtakes the king himself. For then the Spirit of God was upon him also. And he went on and he prophesied until he came to Naoth. And he also stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel in like manner and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore they say, is Saul also among the prophets? Now, I've preached a lot of sermons, but I've never felt the need to do so naked. Hey, rather than a man of the cloth, Saul is here a man of no cloth. He's a preacher streaker. The king falls under the Holy Spirit's influence and he strips down naked. Apparently, Saul proclaimed the bare facts that day. He gave them the naked truth. Actually, the king's nakedness was an expression of his humility and his contrition. And yet understand, mere remorse doesn't always translate into faith and character. People don't realize this, but you can waste an experience with God. You can waste it. That's what Saul does. Oh, the king was moved by God. God touched this man. But what he felt in those moments never translated into a commitment and into a changed character. And this happens in our churches every Sunday. All this experience ends up doing is creates a diversion so that David can escape again. In chapter 20, David catches up with his friend Jonathan. Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah. And he went and he said to Jonathan, and now he pours out his heart to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" David is confused. He's tried to be loyal to the king. So why does King Saul, why is he so angry with him? Why does he want him dead? And so Jonathan said to him, "By no means, you shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing either great or small without first telling me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Jonathan wants David to return to the royal court. And he assures David, "If Saul has any inkling at all to kill you, I'll be the first to know and I'll tell you." David can trust Jonathan to protect him. But then David took an oath again and said, "Your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.'" You see, David might have trusted Jonathan, but he sure didn't trust Saul. And he knew that the king was not beyond trying to pull the wool over the eyes of his own son. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death. That's how he felt. And so Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you yourself desire, I will do it for you." And David concocts a plan that will determine Saul's intentions and as a result, his own future. See, the next day was a special celebration. It was the feast of the new moon. But David decides to skip it intentionally to see how Saul reacts. Jonathan is to tell his dad that David had to go home to Bethlehem to attend to some family business. If Saul approves of David's absence at the feast, then David can feel safe. But if Saul gets angry, then David knows he needs to run for the hills. In verses 8 through 17, David remains worried about this. He questions Jonathan. He says, "Will you really tell me what your father says?" And in verse 12, Jonathan takes an oath. He vows to report to David his father's intentions. And at the end of verse 13, Jonathan says to David, "And the Lord be with you as he has been with my father." Jonathan's words are a blessing on David. You know, "You will be king one day, and as God has blessed my father as king, may God bless you as king." But now, Jonathan wants David to bless him in return. "And you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies." Now Jonathan again caused David to vow because he loved him, and he loved him as he loved his own soul. And so Jonathan pledges his loyalty to David, but he knows that David will be king, not him. And so in return, he asks David to pledge his loyalty to Jonathan's family and to his future descendants, that David will be kind to them once Jonathan is gone. And in verse 18, Jonathan gives David a signal that will communicate his father's intentions. After 3 days, he's to return from Bethlehem, and he's to hide nearby. Jonathan and his aide will go out to practice his archery that day, and he'll shoot 3 arrows. If the arrows land beside the aide, that means that the coast is clear for David to return to Saul's court. But if the arrows go beyond the boy, then David needs to get out of Dodge. He's in danger. In verse 23, Jonathan says goodbye just in case. And he tells David to remember his promise of kindness. Verse 24, then David hid in the field. And when the new moon had come, the king sat down to eat the feast. And now the king sat on his seat, as at other times, on a seat by the wall. And isn't it a strange thing that the king was off by himself, not at the head of the table as you would expect him to be? It's probably another indication of Saul's paranoia and his insecurities here, that he separates himself. And Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, something has happened to him. He's unclean. Saul figures David's absent due to a religious matter. He had defiled himself somehow, ceremonially, and he needed to be cleansed. Verse 27, it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to eat, either yesterday or today? And so Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, please let me go, for our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now, if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore, he has not come to the king's table. You'd think sacrificing to God would certainly be legitimate grounds for an excused absence here. But Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan. And he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. And I don't think I need to translate that for you. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse, and notice Saul can't even bring himself to mention David's name. It's just this son of Jesse. And as long as he lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Saul is now mad at Jonathan for his loyalty to David. And Saul is now trying to disguise his own hatred and jealousy for David as a concern for Jonathan's right to the throne. He says, now therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? Again, taking up for his friend. Then Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew it was determined by his father to kill David. Finally, Jonathan gets the point. Saul's jealousy is out of control. He claims to care about his son's right to the throne, and then he tries to end his life on the end of a spear. King Saul has become unhinged. Verse 34, and so Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food, for he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully. And then the next morning, Jonathan goes out and practices his archery, and he brings along that boy who will retrieve his arrows. And Jonathan shoots his arrows, as agreed upon earlier with David. Three arrows go beyond the boy. Of course, David is hiding and he's watching this. And he realizes that Jonathan is warning him. Saul wants to harm him. He wants to kill him still. When the boy leaves, David comes out of hiding. And he bows down before Jonathan. In verse 41, we're told, and they kissed one another and they wept together, but David more so. It was a tearful farewell between two friends. And then Jonathan said to David, go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, may the Lord be between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever. And so he, David, arose and departed, and Prince Jonathan went into the city. And here is where I need to very reluctantly bring up an unsavory subject. I wish I didn't have to mention this and run the risk of tarnishing a beautiful story. But you need to be aware of a heretical interpretation of this friendship. There are LGBTQ advocates who try to justify same-sex relationships by pointing to David and Jonathan as an example. They suggest that this was somehow a homosexual relationship. And that is both ridiculous and blasphemous. Though verse 41 says they kissed one another, please understand these men lived in an Oriental culture where among men a kiss was a customary greeting. It was a sign of friendship. It was the equivalent of a friendly handshake, not a romantic gesture. You see this among Middle Eastern and European men even to this day. Later in 2 Samuel 1, when Jonathan dies, David will say that his love, Jonathan's love for him, had surpassed the love of women. But he was comparing his relationship with Jonathan with that of Jonathan's two sisters. You remember both his two sisters, Michael, were David's wife. And yet neither of his wives showed him the loyalty that Jonathan had. I believe to misinterpret the depth of friendship and emotion between David and Jonathan as an unnatural and sinful perversion is actually an indictment against the shallowness of most male friendships today. You know, men try to act macho. Yeah. I do it too. They assume that repressing, not expressing emotion is a sign of real manhood. You know, a couple of guys getting teary-eyed gets really weird. But it shouldn't. It shouldn't. For men are human beings. We feel as well as think and act. Male emotion comes out on the battlefield. When a brother gets wounded, you'll see then how emotional men can be toward each other. Or on a football field after a hard-fought game. You know, if you score a touchdown, you're allowed to hug somebody for about 5 seconds. But, you know, given the rawness of the moment and the emotion, you know, men can express their emotions, and they should. They need to. Don't be confused here. David and Jonathan had a healthy, holy, brotherly love for each other, and we should have the same kinds of love for each other. Men today should bond together with strong bonds. We, too, need to model the depth that can be experienced in godly friendships. That's what's going on here. Chapter 21. Now David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. Now in the days of the judges, shortly after Eli, you remember after the Philistines had assaulted the tabernacle at Shiloh, whatever was left of the tabernacle was moved to the city of Nob. The priesthood was also relocated to Nob. And Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?" Now, David's a celebrity, and usually celebrities, they travel in posses. You know, he's a member of the royal court here. And so David's used to traveling with a lot of people with him, his posse. But here David comes to town by himself with very few people. He may have had a couple of people with him, but it was very few. Essentially, he was alone. And Ahimelech is wondering, what's up with that? Why is someone like David alone? And so David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, 'Do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I sent you or what I have commanded you.'" David says that the king has sent him out on a job and he's to keep a low profile. Obviously, this was a lie. He's running from the king. And then he says that his men are out on errands and they all need food. Actually, David is the one who hasn't had anything to eat. He's on the run, and the man is hungry. And when hungry men are on the run, they need to eat. And the priest answered David and said, "There's no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread." Well, I have some bread, but it's holy bread. What he was referring to was the sacred showbread. Those 12 loaves that were to be eaten only by the high priest that were placed in the inner court of the tabernacle. You know, the showbread spoke of fellowship with God. The word showbread literally means bread of faces. And it conjures up the idea of sitting down at God's table and eating with God face to face. This is the kind of fellowship we can have with God through Jesus. F.B. Meyer referred to showbread as presence bread. And only the priest could eat this showbread. But Ahimelech is about to make an exception. And David gives him a couple of reasons why this exception to the law and him eating the bread would be appropriate in this case. I'm just going to summarize this for you. First, he and his men were religiously fit. In other words, if they had engaged in sex with their wives the night before, they would need until evening to restore their religious readiness to take part in a tabernacle ritual. In other words, they would have to abstain till evening in order to be clean again. But David says it's been 3 days since mommy and daddy time. We're cool. We're clear here. We're clean. And then second, sacred bread, holy bread, was always fresh, whereas this bread had already been taken off the altar, and so it was considered common bread. So he gives him two reasons why he should eat the bread, why he could eat the bread. And apparently David's arguments were very convincing. For in verse 6 we're told, so the priest gave him the holy bread, for there was no bread there but the showbread which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. And this all becomes very important when we get over to the New Testament. For in Matthew chapter 12, Jesus will use this story to refute the legalistic Pharisees. On the Sabbath day, as Jesus and his men walked through the fields, they would pluck and they would eat some of the grain. They would grind it up in their hands and they would eat it on the Sabbath. And the legalistic Jews saw this as a violation of the law. But Jesus answered them, "Have you not read?" And he's referring here to our text, 1 Samuel chapter 21. What David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests. Obviously, human need had taken precedent over religious ritual. God had mercy on David's hunger. Human need took precedent over religious ritual. Also in Matthew, Jesus quotes Hosea 6, verse 6. He says, "For God desires mercy and not sacrifice." Removing a man's hunger is a higher priority to God than keeping ceremonial bread. The law was made to help humans, not hurt them. So when the letter of the law contradicts the intent of the law, then the spirit or intent takes precedent. Alleviating hunger is holier, a holier act than lighting a candle or giving a tithe or performing some ritual. You're actually helping people. That's what God cares about. That's what Jesus taught us. Now, a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. And his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul. Turns out this Doeg is going to rat out David. He's one of Saul's spies. And David said to Ahimelech, "Is there not here on hand a spear or a sword? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste." Now David's on the run. He needs a weapon. And so the priest said, "The sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, there it is, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is no other except that one here." And David said, "There is none like it. Give it to me." And you wonder, when David picked up Goliath's sword, did he take a second or a minute? Did he massage the handle, you know, and remember what it was like? Did he swing it a time or two, you know, in the air? Did he spend a minute reliving the thrill he had when he sliced off that giant's head with that sword? Well, the priest was probably holding on to the sword as a keepsake. Maybe he planned to sell it online later. auction it off on Jubei. But here's another point. Don't turn weapons into keepsakes. Don't turn weapons into keepsakes. The keepsakes we care about are heavenly things. Those are the eternal things that we live for. Those are our keepsakes. What God gives us here on earth needs to be used for His glory. It needs to be used as weapons. Verse 10. Then David arose and he fled that day from before Saul. And he went to Achish, the king of Gath. And it was probably not the smartest move to wear Goliath of Gath's sword down Main Street in Goliath's hometown. For the servants of Achish said to him, "Is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in dances, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? Why David fled to Philistine country, we're not sure, especially to Goliath's hometown. Maybe he thought he'd been forgotten by the Philistines, not hardly. Maybe he figured the enemy territory was the only place that Saul wouldn't chase him. That's more likely. Maybe he felt that the Philistines at least respected him because of his victories, perhaps. Whatever the reason, David felt safer among Saul's enemies than he did with Saul. Verse 12. And now David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. And so he changed his behavior before them. He feigned madness in their hands, scratched on the doors of the gate, and let his saliva fall down on his beard. I mean, when David entered Gath, he grew frightened. He realized he'd made a mistake. He feared retaliation. And to avoid it, he pretended to be mad. He went animal style. He started scratching at the walls and foaming at the mouth. And it worked. For then Achish said to his servants, "Look, you see this man is insane. Why have you brought him here to me? Don't we already have enough crazy people in Gath? Have I need of madmen that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? In short, get this guy out of here. We got enough crazy people around here." David's plan succeeds. And there are two psalms, Psalm 34 and Psalm 56, that are written in the aftermath of this episode. And both extol how God delivers his people in times of trouble. Listen to Psalm 34. Verse 17, which was written on this occasion. David cries out, "The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to those who have a broken heart and saves such as have a contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all." And a beautiful psalm was written from this occasion. Now in chapter 22, David attracts a crowd. David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. And so he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him. Now the cave of Adullam was a stronghold just east of modern Tel Aviv. It's a little south of the Elah Valley where David slew Goliath. The cave became a camp, one of David's fugitive hideouts, the cave of Adullam. And while he was there, a motley crew was attracted to David. He was joined by a band of misfits, the distressed, the in debt, the discontented. These were the folks rejected and despised by the Jewish society of King Saul. And they now find family among the friends of David. This is also what will happen later to the son of David. Jesus will attract the outcasts and the disenfranchised. Jesus brought rest to the distressed. He forgave the debtor and made him heir to his riches. He gave peace and satisfaction to the discontented. And this also sounds a lot like Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. Many of us are among the distressed and the in debt. Do I hear an amen? And the discontented. But we found a fresh start and a new identity in Jesus Christ. And then David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, an area east of the Dead Sea. And he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me." Now David is concerned now for his family's safety. Saul can try to get to him by harming his parents. And King Saul was not above kidnapping or extortion. So David hopes that Moab will provide his family with political asylum. And it's no surprise that he turns to Moab as a safe house. Remember, David had Moabite connections. In fact, he had Moabite blood. You remember his grandma, Ruth, great-grandma Ruth, was a Moabitess. And so he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. And then the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold, depart and go to the land of Judah." A new prophet, Gad, comes on the scene and he sends David further south. And so David departed and went into the forest of Hereth. Verse 6, when Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered, now Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah with his spear in his hand. And that's not a good picture. Somebody's in danger. Saul's got a spear. And all his servants standing about him. And then Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse," he's still not calling him David, still can't say his name, "will he give you every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds?" In other words, I'm the king, not David. I'm the one who can reward you and promote you. Fight for me. And in verse 8, Saul sulks. He has a pity party. He thinks everyone's out to get him. He moans, "There is no one of you who is sorry for me." Poor Saul. Saul accuses the entire nation of betrayal. All Israel has sided with Jonathan, he says. And then verse 9. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul, and said, "I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine." Doeg, you remember him? Back in Nob? Here he rats out Ahimelech for helping David. And so the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests who were in Nob. And they all came to the king, and Saul said, "Hear now, son of Ahitub." And he answered, "Here I am, my lord." Then Saul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day?" Again, Saul's fixated on David trying to kill him when in reality he's the one trying to kill David. And so Ahimelech answered the king and said, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law, who goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house?" See, Ahimelech's stunned by all this. He tells Saul, he said, "Hold on now. I thought David was on your team. He's done nothing I've seen to betray you." He continues, verse 15, "Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Far be it from me. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to any in the house of my father, for your servant knew nothing of all this, little or much." You remember David had lied to Ahimelech and had said that he was on a mission for the king. In helping David, Ahimelech thought that he had been helping King Saul. And the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." And then the king said to the guards who stood about him, "Turn and kill the priest of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell it to me." And again, Saul issues a rash order. But the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priest of the Lord. This was some civil disobedience. They put God above the king. To take a sword to the priest would be to slaughter God's anointed. Despite being innocent, they were also God's priests. They refused to obey the king. But, oh, Doeg. And the king said to Doeg, "You turn and kill the priests." Doeg was the only man evil enough and ruthless enough to do this dirty deed. And so Doeg, the Edomite, turned and struck the priests and killed on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. The ephod was the priestly uniform. Also, Nob, the city of the priest, he struck with the edge of the sword both men and women, children and nursing infants, oxen and donkeys and sheep with the edge of the sword. Doeg proved to be as bloodthirsty as Saul. Verse 20. Now one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled from after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priests. And so David said to Abiathar, "I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul. I smelled a rat. I should have done something about it. I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house." And I want to point out, here is a great example of David's heart. Remember, he was a man after God's own heart. And here's a great example of his pure heart. You know, he could have, perhaps he should have, blamed this disaster on Saul's rage or on Doeg's cruelty. Instead, David looked inward and he holds himself responsible. He's played a part in this. If I had not gone to Nob pretending to be on a royal mission, perhaps none of this would have happened. And he takes personal responsibility for his part in this disaster. Of course, we don't know for sure. If Ahimelech had known the truth, he might have been more inclined to help David. But David's first impulse was to search his own heart. Is that your first impulse? Is your first impulse to search your own heart, or is it to blame someone else for the problem? David searched his own heart first. This is the mark of a true leader. This is the mark of a man with a heart after God. Well, Ahimelech's son Abiathar was the sole survivor, his only heir. And David will pay off his perceived debt to Ahimelech by ensuring the safety of his son Abiathar. And in the last verse of chapter 22, David promises Abiathar, "Stay with me, do not fear, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. But with me, you shall be safe." And let me close this morning with some important typology that I think makes all this even more important and relevant to you and me. I want you to see this picture. David is king, but he has yet to take the throne. In the meantime, he's gathering up society's rejects. He and his followers are now subject to persecution. Saul, the usurper, is sitting on the throne. And he's venting his rage and frustrations on David's merry men. And it's all a picture of what's going on in the world around us today. Today, Jesus has been anointed king of this earth. Yet Satan, like Saul, still sits on the throne. Satan is a usurper. And he wants to destroy the coming king and his misfit followers. That's you and me. But one day, Jesus is going to take the crown. He's going to rule the world. Satan will be judged. And Jesus' motley crew will reign and rule with him for 1,000 years. That's what we have to look forward to. What a day that will be. In the meantime, trust God. Stay close to the Son of David, Jesus Christ, our warrior, our hero. And live your life for Him. And seek to bring Him glory.